This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And we begin with the news released today that in January, United States drone strikes in Pakistan killed two hostages being held by al-Qaeda.
I want to express our grief and condolences to the families of two hostages. One American, Dr. Warren Weinstein, and an Italian, Giovanni Laporto, who were tragically killed in a U.S. counterterrorism operation.
That's President Obama speaking at the White House. Dr. Warren Weinstein was an American aid worker for the United States Agency for International Development. He had been held captive since 2011. Here's Weinstein speaking on a video released by al-Qaeda 2 years ago.
I came to Pakistan to help my government, and I did so at a time when most Americans would not come here. And now when I need my government, it seems that I have been totally abandoned and forgotten.
In a statement, Weinstein's family said those who took Warren captive over 3 years ago bear ultimate responsibility. We can assure you that he would still be alive and well if they had allowed him to return home after his time abroad working to help the people of Pakistan, end quote. The family also says it was disappointed with the U.S. government's response to Weinstein's captivity. The operation also killed American al-Qaeda leader Ahmed Farouk, and in a separate airstrike, Adam Gadan, known as Azam the American. Gadan was a senior operative inside al-Qaeda with close ties to Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. He was a media advisor and spokesman for the terrorist organization.
I mean, even assuming that America is not at war with Islam today, how can Obama be so certain that America will never be at war with Islam?
In the last decade, more than 2,500 people have been killed in U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan. And whenever a drone strike occurs, the Pakistani Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemns it. But they are routine. The most recent strike on April 12th in South Waziristan killed four people, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The United States is known to have intentionally killed six alleged al-Qaeda members who are U.S. citizens. Some were specifically targeted, some not. Anwar al-Awlaki, Samir Khan, June Kenan Mohammed, Kamal Derwish, who is a member of the Lackawanna Six in 2002, are among them. Joining me now in the studio is Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Welcome back to the show, Karen.
Thanks for having me back.
We have two separate issues here, the apparently accidental killing of Warren Weinstein in a strike, but then also the intentional, if not targeted, killing of two American al-Qaeda operatives. Put into context today the president's apology and the wider drone war as it exists today.
I think underscoring these deaths is the fact that if there are going to be targeted strikes, as much of the world has always said, there will be collateral damage. And that collateral damage can be, as President Obama said, heartbreaking, heartrending. And I think that's what we've seen in part today, that you have these two separate things. One, a top al-Qaeda operatives being killed, and two, collateral damage, which have to do with the Italian and the American that Obama named today in his speech.
The president said in his statement that basically U.S. intelligence operations didn't know that Weinstein and Laporto were on hand when they bombed a compound.
Right. And that's most likely true. But it doesn't mean that you can't expect that that might happen. It might happen in part because they were put there as human shields. You don't know that. It might have happened by coincidence. But the fact is that in targeted killings, we know that there is collateral damage. And in this case, the collateral damage was an Italian and an American hostage.
The drone killing of Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen helped to bring about a public debate on what's called the kill list, basically the president signing off and targeting American citizens who are deemed to be al-Qaeda members. The White House today said that these two American al-Qaeda members were not specifically targeted, but they were intentionally killed because they are viewed as targets. Put that into some context for us.
I think the larger context is here is the developing legalization at the top levels for drone killings, including for drone killings of Americans, which happens to be the part of the the program that we know the most about. Adam Gadahn has always been somebody who that the top officials have had tremendous concern about. He was radicalized in the 90s at the age of 17. He went abroad before he was 20. He has been at the intersection of the top leadership of Al-Qaeda and the interaction with Americans, trying to recruit them via media, etc.
Well, that would have made him a high-value intelligence target, not necessarily a target to be killed.
Well, it could have. And one of the problems, from the point of view of many people, is that if you're going to kill somebody like Anwar al-Awlaki or Adam Gadahn, you are going to forfeit the intelligence value they might have about the intersection between these two places, Pakistan or the al-Qaeda network writ large, and the United States.
Especially at a time when there's so much concern about Americans going abroad to fight with terrorist organizations. Karen Greenberg is director at the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Karen, thank you.
Thank you.
We turn to Washington now, where it's a very rare moment indeed when Republicans agree with President Barack Obama. But when it comes to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's a massive trade deal with nearly a dozen countries around the Pacific who represent 40% of the world economy. Republicans are not just behind the White House, but hoping to grant the president the authority to fast-track the deal. If passed, it would be the largest trade deal to go into effect since NAFTA was enacted in 1994. Now, the deal is sharply dividing the president from a lot of people in his own party. Here's Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking on CBS This Morning earlier this month.
I have real concerns about something that basically would permit multinational companies to sue other countries when they try to put regulations in place to protect their own workers, to protect their own citizens. I think this is a really dangerous provision in a trade deal.
And does that put you on the opposite side from the president?
It certainly does.
It certainly does.
Well, that prompted the president to go on MSNBC this week to defend the deal.
I love Elizabeth. We're allies on a whole host of issues, but she's wrong on this.
The president went on.
I would not be doing this trade deal if I did not think it was good for the middle class. And when you hear folks make a lot of suggestions about how bad this trade deal is, when you dig into the facts, they are wrong.
Well, the opposition isn't just Elizabeth Warren. It includes a vast majority of House Democrats and goes all the way to Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid. So the president and Republicans now are agreeing to give the public time to review the now secret deal once it's finalized. That is likely to be the next president's problem. Well, we have two voices now, one for and one against the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Fast Track. First, Lori Wallach. She's director of Global Trade Watch. It's a division of Public Citizen. Lori is critical of the deal. Lori, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So Congress this week is dealing with the Fast Track portion of this whole deal, giving the president more authority to push through the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Do you think there's a chance Democrats could kill it?
The way it looks right now is the vote that's up is a procedure. It's not the agreement. It's a very archaic, undemocratic procedure that actually Nixon cooked up, rarely been used. It's called Fast Track. And it would basically take away all of Congress's normal overview and procedural safeguards about a vote. And that vote right now, there is almost no Democratic support in Congress. And there are a lot of Republican rank and file members who are opposed. So the way the politics lines up, bizarrely, is it's the president and the Republican leadership in Congress, plus the hugest pack of corporations, all the interests that tried to wipe him out as a president, didn't want him reelected. And that would be the pharmaceutical companies and the oil and gas companies and the big multinational producers are chronic job offshorers and the big retailers like Walmart and Kmart. And then the other side is the entire Democratic base. Because the TPP would not only make it easier to offshore our jobs and undermine our wages by throwing us in competition with Vietnam, but also, as Senator Warren has pointed out, would roll back financial regulation, would make us import food that doesn't meet our safety standards, would roll back some of the energy conservation and climate policies this president struggled to put into place. You have the broadest coalition of the entire Democratic base, from consumer and environmental groups, to the faith and family farm groups, to the internet freedom groups, to the unions, to small business organizations, the opposition, and almost every member, Democratic member of Congress, is stunning.
Well, Lori, a lot of the discomfort in that coalition that you just mentioned goes back to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, 1993, 1994. What went wrong with NAFTA in the perception of that coalition that you're talking about that's making them so very opposed to the deal today?
Well, TPP is actually based, the text is based on the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, which President Obama did in 2012. And that agreement, the Korea agreement, was based on NAFTA in 1993. The crux of what's wrong with NAFTA is that it has, over its 21 years, resulted in an enormous loss of not just U.S. manufacturing jobs, but it has also resulted in losses of service sector jobs, downward pressure on wages. But it's not just NAFTA, that agreement. That agreement heralded in a model of trade agreements. And at the heart of those agreements is the most job-losing provision of the TPP. It's a provision that incentivizes job offshoring by providing special rights and privileges to foreign investors if they relocate the jobs. Now, all the TPP has been negotiated in extreme secrecy, but luckily WikiLeaks leaked that chapter of TPP. It's called the investment chapter. The result from NAFTA was that literally 40,000 companies up and relocated. Well, the other thing that both the TPP and NAFTA have is a ban on buy local or buy American. So you actually also end up offshoring our tax dollars.
Well, Lori Wallach, what's wrong with the principle of these trade deals, which basically say it's a global economy where countries have to interact in a new way? And yes, you lose certain kinds of jobs in a free trade deal. You mentioned a lot of them, a lot of manufacturing jobs for sure. But when you do it, you reorient your economy in a more accessible way that gives you access to emerging markets in places like Asia, Europe, places like that.
So trade is good, and we have to figure out how to expand our exports and be successful in the globalized economy, no doubt. The problem with TPP and the question with every trade agreement is trade, yes, but under what rules? Who writes them and who are they set to benefit? This has become a corporate Trojan horse to implement a lot of policies that wouldn't and in fact haven't passed in Congress. This is the most threatening attack on middle-class jobs and wages, but also many of the most important consumer and environmental protections on which all of our families rely.
Lori Wallach is director of Global Trade Watch. It's a division of Public Citizen. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now a view in support of the deal. Our next guest is Susan Schwab, former U.S. trade representative under President George W. Bush. She's currently a professor at the University of Maryland. Susan Schwab, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Is the Trans-Pacific Partnership a Trojan horse, as Lori Wallach said, one that benefits pharmaceutical companies, limits internet freedom, undermines environmental regulations and wages?
No, it appears to be a very fine agreement, very strong, very robust, and will, like our previous free trade agreements with 20 other countries, go a long way in increasing U.S. exports, increasing benefits to U.S. consumers, small, medium size, as well as large exporters, farmers, manufacturers, workers, service providers, a whole variety of U.S. Interests. And that includes environmental interests and a whole raft of groups that are well represented in advising Congress, advising our negotiators.
Susan Schwab, what about parts of this deal apparently that give multinational corporations the power to challenge domestic environmental and labor laws, that basically let the companies who have a stake in the trade to try to undermine environmental regulations, wage regulations, workplace safety regulations?
Well, I think you ought to take a look at the existing trade agreements, starting with the free trade agreement that was negotiated with Peru, Colombia, South Korea, Panama. The last four, for example, have enforceable labor and environmental standards. These are provisions that were demanded by labor and environmental groups in the United States for 10, 15 years. And then lo and behold, once they were included in trade agreements as enforceable standards, those groups in the United States that had said, oh, but for the lack of these provisions, we would support trade agreements, now they've come up with other reasons for opposing these trade agreements. If you look at labor and environmental standards, for example, these are provisions that within the last 10 years or so, we have included in free trade agreements. These are enforceable provisions, standards involving labor and the environment. They are included as negotiating objectives now in the Trade Promotion Authority legislation that was marked up by the Senate Finance Committee in this new Trade Promotion Authority legislation that was introduced in the House and the Senate this past week. In terms of the so-called investor state provision that I think is the one you're referring to, that language is particularly designed for countries where the judicial system is not particularly trustworthy. And we are all familiar with countries where that is the case. But I think the key for those who care about protection of the environment, who care about labor standards and labor rights, is not for us to be sitting on our hands, but rather to be continuing to negotiate free trade agreements that include these kinds of standards that we've been putting into our trade agreements since the 2006-2007 era trade agreements.
Well, of course, Susan Schwab, the president is on your side on this one, but a big part of his political base isn't, and they're getting more and more vocal. The White House has acknowledged to reporters and a lot of other people that NAFTA hasn't lived up to the hype, in the White House's words, and that the president is really making a special new effort for enforceable environmental regulations, workplace safety, workers' protections in this deal. Your assessment of the geopolitical balance of power right now, does the president have new leverage, more leverage than maybe we had or wanted during NAFTA, for the president to assuage the concerns of so many people on his left?
Well, I would have liked to have seen the president move earlier on trade promotion authority and a trade agenda. I think you find a lot of Republicans who would have liked to see that. You would have found a lot of Democrats who would like to see that. I mean, trade is, in fact, bipartisan. I think perhaps you exaggerate to an extent the number of Democrats who oppose trade. Unfortunately, you've got this very strong, as you note, and vocal opposition from a wing of the Democratic Party. It is controlled by big labor. If you look at who is going to benefit, it's American workers who are going to benefit. It's American farmers. It's ranchers. You do not win in trade by ignoring the 95% of consumers, global consumers, who are sitting outside our borders. You do not win in global trade by letting other countries negotiate free trade agreements around the world that exclude us. You don't win by walking off the field.
Susan Schwab, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Susan Schwab is former U.S. Trade Representative under President George W. Bush.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
We turn now to Chile, where a volcano has erupted twice in the last 24 hours after having been dormant since 1972. The eruption sent a massive column of lava and ash miles into the sky. Chileans have been surprised by the abruptness and force of the two eruptions. Schools have been closed, flights canceled, and residents in the area are wondering whether the volcanic activity will subside or if this is a massive natural disaster in the making. Gideon Long is a freelance reporter for the BBC and joins me now from Santiago. Hi, Gideon.
Hi there, Todd.
Give us a sense of context about the size of the eruptions, if you can.
Okay, so we've had two eruptions so far. The first one was at 6 o'clock in the evening yesterday, local time, and then another eruption around 7 hours later in the middle of the night here in Chile. Both of them large eruptions, and both of them unexpected. Nobody was expecting this volcano to erupt. I've just been listening to an interesting interview with a volcanologist here in Chile. She was saying that in 95% of the cases of volcanic eruptions, they know it's going to happen. They have some warnings, earth tremors, etc. But in this case, there was this falls into the 5%. There was no warning at all. So it was completely unexpected. Very spectacular images coming out of the south of Chile of this huge plume of ash and smoke rising around 10 kilometers, around 6 miles into the air. And it's forced the evacuation of everybody in the area within a 20 kilometer radius. That's around a 13 mile radius of the volcano's peak.
So there was real concern that people anywhere close to the cone could actually be in danger here.
There was. The volcano was clearly visible from the city of Puerto Montt, which is a sizable city in the south of Chile. It's only around 20 miles from the volcano. And there are some smaller towns and villages which are nearer still. The town of Ensenada, for example, has been completely evacuated. That's been the main concern. It's the town closest to the volcano. And the reports coming out of there suggest that the town is now a ghost town. Everybody has been evacuated from that area. As you said, schools in the area have been closed. All flights to Puerto Montt and to nearby airports have been closed. And the worry is now that the ash is drifting eastwards over the Andes Mountains, and there is some danger that it will start falling on fields both in Chile and also in neighboring Argentina. Even as far away as Bariloche, a city in Argentina, around 50 miles from the volcano, people there have been told to stay indoors. And the worry is also for agriculture. There's a danger that the ash will fall on fields, making it difficult for livestock in the area to graze, and also block up waterways, which are obviously vital for the agricultural sector in the area.
So is the worry now primarily that ash that you're talking about? Is there significant lava flow that threatens towns and villages in the area of the volcano itself?
I think that is the main worry. In terms of people being evacuated, it seems to have been a fairly orderly evacuation. And this is primarily an agricultural area, so it's not heavily populated. Around 5,000 people have been told they will have to leave their homes. But so far, that seems to be a fairly orderly process. And I think the main concern really is for agriculture. We've seen this in previous volcanic eruptions in Chile, where fields in the area are carpeted in a layer of ash. The livestock can't graze and they die. So that's the main concern.
And some people might remember or might want to look up images from Mount St. Helens in Washington State back in the 80s, which dumped, in some cases, feet of ash in surrounding towns. People dug their way out of ashfall with snow shovels. Gideon Long, freelance reporter with the BBC in Santiago. Thanks, Gideon.
Thank you.
You can see some amazing photos of the Calbuco volcano erupting. It's on our website at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. You know, we cover nations under strife all the time on this show. Syria, Nigeria, Yemen. And a lot of times we talk about how people can respond to an oppressive government. There are protests. There's violence, of course. Those are some of the more common vehicles for dissent and anger. But how about music?
I'm moving to Brussels. I'm moving to Spain. To Harlem, it's all the same.
For singer-songwriter B. Beeman, the answer took the form of his compositions. Beeman is Sri Lankan American, and he's been making music since 2008. He decided this year to write a sort of Dear John letter to his former dictator in Sri Lanka. The song is called Moving to Brussels.
To Brussels.
It appears on his new album, Rhythm and Reason, that'll be out in May. He shot a video for the track with Keegan-Michael Key. That's the guy from Key and Peele, and he's touring nationally now. B joins me here in the studio. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your Dear John letter in moving to Brussels, who's it to?
Well, it's a little bit about the Sri Lankan former president, but it's also a universal thing. I come from an immigrant family, and I sort of identify with immigrants. I'm in a lot of cabs a lot, and I chat them up. I like to talk about their families and their histories and stuff like that. But I just thought it was a great opportunity to sort of take a love song, like a breakup love song, kind of spin it in this way that millions of people actually experience of having to leave their homes and their families and their loved ones and everything they knew and leave sight unseen to a new land.
So what you're speaking to in a very calm and sort of beautiful way in these songs, though, is upheaval, political strife, relocation. How does such a beautiful song, in a way, such a calm song, help channel what must be a lot of frustration for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely frustration. I'm privileged to be living in America, and my family brought us to a great place in St. Louis where I grew up. People's stories like that resonate with me, and I have a lot of family members who still live in Sri Lanka. It's just something I like to address something in each of my songs, and I'm not trying to be overly political necessarily or change anybody's minds, but it's something in my heart that I feel needs to be said.
Politicians never see the brown boys starving like Malcolm X and Martin King and Marcus Garvey. Yeah. In 65 there was a climate for the riots, and it's 89 and I'm seeing deja vu again.
My parents came from Sri Lanka, formerly Ceylon, through San Jose, California, and then they finally landed in St. Louis, and I was born there in St. Louis. In certain ways, I was one of only a handful, seemingly, of South Asian people or Asian people in St. Louis in the 80s. That sort of alien living on the inside from the outside sort of viewpoint definitely is all over my music, and it's something I bring to the table that I'm not sure is seen too much in this Americana blues country, whatever you want to call what I'm doing, world. So
it sounds a little bit to me like in moving to Brussels, you're sort of channeling your parents' experience a little bit. Yeah. Their movements from Sri Lanka to the United States. You came afterward. You haven't really experienced that yourself, but you've talked to them quite a bit, to your other relatives too, I'm sure.
It was just part of my upbringing. But it wasn't always about Sri Lanka either. It's just what's going on in the world. It was never just about my city or my state or my country necessarily. It was about the whole world, and we kind of share it with everybody. So
the president of Sri Lanka, Maithripala Sirisena, has said that he's going to dissolve the parliament, call new elections later on this summer. It seems like a real moment there.
Yeah, it's definitely a new day. People are sort of maybe holding their breath, waiting to see what actually transpires. But what you hear from him is definitely promising. It seems like a different attitude, a more conciliatory attitude than was ever there before.
Speaking of conciliation, there are also indications that there may be a sort of truth and reconciliation commission coming around on the heels of the civil war there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very dark, depending on what side you're on, but there's a lot of documentation about how dark that the ending of that war was. You know, I don't know. I don't know how much dwelling on the past really fixes anything. But I mean, if human atrocities were committed, I mean, somebody needs to be reckoned with, I guess.
If anything, it might provide a lot more inspiration for more art. That's for sure.
That's what I'm hoping out of all of this.
I have to ask, and I'm sorry if this kind of question bugs you, but what do you think about MIA?
She stood up for Tamils in Sri Lanka in 2009 very strongly. She was on Tavis Smiley. I saw her. And nobody else was talking about it. And I love that she was talking about it. And she gave a voice to people that Americans maybe don't see very often. But musically, she's just a whole other bag. I'm not into electronic music particularly, but I respect her for sure.
B. Beeman, do you have favorite protest songs, political artists that you've listened to?
I was talking to somebody about this, and Phil Oakes' name came up.
Oh, yeah.
But I actually don't really love Phil Oakes. I think he is talking about politics, but not covering it with enough honey. He's not, there's not a great melody. The songs aren't particularly memorable. So I don't love protest songs just for the sake of protesting. People will buy what you're selling if you just give it a little bit of sugar on top. My main concern with writing a song is making sure the melody is nice, the instrumentation is nice, and then so kind of through the back door getting my message through.
Move over to Oakland, my future's wide open. See sister in Sydney, and you ain't coming with me.
You can catch B. Beeman on tour this spring and summer across America. His new album, Rhythm and Reason, will be out in May. B. Beeman, thanks a lot for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks.
B. Beeman performed for us live here in the Takeaway Studios. To listen to those tracks, go to thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
You know, everyone goes to work and puts up with things that you wouldn't otherwise tolerate. Sometimes it's just what you gotta do to get a paycheck.
This is Daniel from Dallas, Texas. My coworkers are all middle-aged and up. I'm 22 myself. And they are constantly making homophobic and sexist remarks. As an LGBT person, I would never tolerate this anywhere else. But if I come out at work, I can easily be fired because Texas law doesn't protect me from employment discrimination based solely on my sexual orientation or gender identity.
Hi, my name is Carmela Kwame. I'm calling from Boca Raton, Florida. The behavior that I tolerate in order to make a living is the deep-rooted prejudice of the elders that I take care of in Palm Beach County. It's unfortunate, but I'm glad that I do what I do. I take care of them as if they were my parents.
Well, our next guest can certainly relate. Brittany Bronson is an English instructor at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas, and she's also a cocktail waitress in America's most scandalous town. And she's dealing with a dilemma that a lot of us might be familiar with, tolerating some bad behavior at work that she otherwise would never tolerate in the real world. And in Brittany's case, it's constant sexual harassment. The trade-off is better tips, but it's a compromise that she's not entirely comfortable with.
What I'm doing at work is more of a performance, and how I'd react outside of work is more truly reflective of kind of my ideas and what's important to me. So in this case in particular, when a man makes a sexist comment or makes an advance that I find inappropriate, I have to act in a different way for the sake of my job.
So just understanding how this dynamic works, Brittany, when you're a cocktail waitress and you're subjected to sexualized comments or even touching or stares or suggestions that you might be available for services after work, things like that. Is this all part of the Las Vegas sort of tourist fantasy, or is this a common experience, do you think, that a lot of people in your position, whether in Las Vegas or not, experience on a regular basis?
I definitely think that it's exemplified in Las Vegas, and that I'm serving drinks, I'm in a revealing outfit, I'm walking around, and obviously people are coming to let loose and feel that they want to have a sexual encounter, or they are soliciting that as they're in Vegas, and that's kind of the stereotype. But I've found, regardless of the restaurant that I worked in, this isn't an unusual thing. It might happen more often because I'm in an environment that's hypersexualized, but when I've worked in other states, sexual harassment has occurred just as frequently.
And so you write about this conflict within yourself. In the outside world, I'm a feminist. I teach about feminism. I consider myself a feminist who wouldn't stand for this type of behavior in the local big box store shopping.
Right.
But at work, it's different.
Yeah, it is. If some of the men said to me in a store what they said to me in a restaurant, I would say something back. I would walk out. I would exit from the situation. But In a restaurant setting where I'm meant to be cordial and have a relationship with my guests, I'll laugh or I'll make a joke or I'll smile and pretend that I'm on board, even though inside I don't feel comfortable with what comment is being made or if a hand is on my shoulder, is on my hip, or a guest hugs me or puts me in their arms or something like that. I kind of tolerate it or I excuse it because I've, in a way, come to accept that maybe it's a part of my job.
And you say you've left your feminism at the casino door because if you stand up for yourself, you won't make money. It's as simple as that.
I feel that I can handle excusing it. I'm tough enough to get through it in order to protect that tip that I need and that I want. So I make a kind of compromise for the sake of making and ensuring and protecting my income.
You know, on the other hand, Brittany Bronson, there's nothing that's right about that behavior, but I'm reading your piece thinking there's part of this, you know, all of us in our jobs exercise some depersonalization if we want to be successful. There are jerks everywhere, and that's not to say that any part of you should be okay with this behavior. But even outside of the cocktail bars and the restaurants and the casinos of Las Vegas, every single person probably at some point has to put aside someone else's jerky behavior and say, if I react the way I really want to, I'm probably not going to be able to work here anymore.
Absolutely. I agree. I think all jobs have a kind of performative element or a kind of moment when you have to just get over it, per se, or move on or kind of sweep a blanket under the rug. But I think what I'm trying to point out is that for women in the service industry, not just those who are in a highly sexualized position like mine is cocktailing, but across the country have to deal with this at a much more frequent rate and much more frequently than their male colleagues working the same position. So it's more about the disproportionate experience for people in my industry. A recent report called The Glass Floor, put out in October by the Restaurant Opportunity Center, states that those states with a tipped minimum wage, where servers can be paid as low as $2.13 an hour, they're twice as likely to experience sexual harassment than servers in states like mine, where we make the state minimum wage. Or here in Las Vegas, many servers make union wage because our restaurant jobs are such a vital part of our economy that they're protected. So in that case, the more crucial that tip is as your income versus a steady wage, the more likely you are to excuse sexual harassment and to interpret it as less severe or as not as much of a problem.
So what's the feminist conclusion here? I mean, you lay out really clearly your experience, and a lot of it is really demeaning, I have to say. You also say that some of your female colleagues find a way to capitalize on this. You do capitalize on it, of course. What's the bottom line here? Are you comfortable in the end with the way you're making all this extra money at night, or is it something you feel deep down you shouldn't be participating in?
It's something that I've personally have come to peace with in terms of saying that this is my job, this isn't my identity, and my job is just my job. But I think that it's a reality that for working class women, it can be more difficult to access kind of those feminist ideals, or they can be less practical. And I think for women working in service positions, especially in other states, unlike mine, where it's not necessarily a lucrative income, it's not necessarily an income that can provide a middle-class living. It provides an income closer to poverty. And I think that the feminist conclusion to make is, I don't know, I'm not sure. I'm a bad feminist, and I think that's what I'm trying to to put out, that I don't necessarily know how to reconcile, but I just wanted to have the conversation and get the conversation started, because I know a lot of women and my colleagues that I've met my years working in the service industry have expressed this similar kind of internal dilemma of they're not always sure the best way to deal with this problem.
Brittany Bronson is a cocktail waitress in Las Vegas. She is also an instructor at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas and an opinion contributor at the New York Times. Brittany Bronson, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
She's making history, working for victory, Rosie the Riveter.
And here's something for you to take with you today. Mary Doyle Keefe, better known to America as the real-life face of Rosie the Riveter, has died at age 92. Keefe was 19 years old and a telephone operator in 1943 when her neighbor, Norman Rockwell, paid her $10 to model in a blue shirt and loafers. That image was transformed into the iconic Saturday Evening Post cover, Rosie the Riveter, calling on millions of Americans to join the war effort. Well, that's all for today. If you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. You can also ask me anything on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Moo, working to help bring business stories and brands to life through a range of printed products like business cards, flyers, stickers, and postcards. Also offering design templates and the option to upload a personal design. Learn more at Moo.com.